You're listening to SaberCast with Rob Dyer, your home for the deepest insights into baseball, featuring guests from throughout the game. SaberCast is a production of the Society for American Baseball Research. For more information about Saber and to check out the show page, visit saber.org. Now, here's Rob Dyer.
Welcome to another episode of SaberCast with Rob Dyer. I'm Rob Dyer. This is SaberCast, and I'm really thrilled this week to welcome to SaberCast Gary Bedingfield, whose work has been front and center for me for, I don't know how long, 10, 12 years at least. But Gary's got a new book out, so it seemed like the time to have him on the show and talk about the new book, but also all this other tremendous work that he has done. Gary's got this great website, which is where I ran across him, Baseball in Wartime, all about baseball during World War II, overseas baseball. Gary's got a unique perspective on that because he is English, and which helped him in his research a great deal, as we'll talk about. He published his first book in 2009, Baseball's Dead of World War II, where he covered not just the major leaguers who were killed during the war, a small number, but also professional players, all the professional players that he could find. And his research has only expanded since then, and we'll talk about that. His new book, is called Baseball in Hawaii During World War II, and this is an exhaustive survey. I shouldn't say it's exhaustive because I am not exhausted reading it. It's highly enjoyable. Gary's got a great, very accessible style, and there's fantastic images in the book, and it's just a great story. All that talent in Hawaii during World War II, and nobody's ever written the story about that period. And that environment, Gary's done that. Later, I will be joined, as usual, by Sabre CEO Scott Bush. We'll talk about what I've been reading, aside from baseball in Hawaii during World War II. We'll try to figure out who won the weekend. I should mention also, by the way, Gary's website, which is just baseballinwartime.com, we will include on the show page, which course, we encourage everyone to visit, a link to baseballinwartime.com. You can also subscribe to Gary's newsletter there, and a link to the new book. Here's my discussion with Gary Bedingfield. Gary, first, thanks for joining us on SaberCast, and I'm especially thrilled because, well, I'm thrilled for any number of reasons, but one of them is that you are a Saber member, and we have Saber members all around the world, but I believe you're our first international member to join the podcast, so welcome to SaberCast.
Thanks, very, very pleased to be here.
Before we get into the work, and I am excited to talk about that, you and I have been in touch for some years, and I've been enjoying your newsletter for a long, long time. But I don't know really much about your background other than that you didn't grow up in the U.S. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how someone who grew up where you grew up came to love baseball.
Yeah, it seems a little strange. I grew up in England. I live in Scotland these days, but I grew up in England, where baseball is it's played, and it's pretty much all over England. But it's just not a popular game. It's kind of, I suppose you could almost kind of look at it as an underground sport. Really, it's got its little pockets all over the place. So not a popular sport at all. But it's a strange one, really. All my life, I mean, I've got a photograph of me when I was about 3 or 4 years old wearing a baseball glove with a bat and a ball. And we just had some gloves around the house all the time. My dad is a musician, and he had his band had played on US airbases that are here in the UK back in the 50s, 60s, around that sort of time. So I guess he kind of picked up a fondness for baseball. So we always had these gloves in the house. We used to play catch. And then 1976, which was the US bicentennial, obviously, as you know, there was a lot of kind of Americana on TV that year, and we were kind of got little snippets of baseball on TV because that's about all we had back then. Something just caught my attention, and the summer of 76 was the year that we just got a bunch of local guys together, a bunch of local kids. We were, 12, 13 years old. And we spent the summer playing baseball, and then we did that for the next 20 years. And some of the guys that I was playing with in 76, I was still playing with in 96. So it was just just an absolute love for the game. I think baseball does that to you. You either don't get it or you just get hooked, and it never lets go. And, it's never let go.
Now, we don't have time to go into your entire playing career, but I happen to know a little bird. Actually, he's a big bird. He told me some things about your playing career. I believe you played for at least first stretch, the Enfield Spartans, a baseball powerhouse. And in 1991, this is what my bird told me, Gary caught 35 innings over 2 days. He was the MVP of the Spartans that year. Let's see. Here's another one. This is a good story. Tell me if any of these things don't sound exactly.
We're good so far. Yeah.
1994 semifinal game versus the London Warriors. Heated rivalry, close game. Last Warriors batter is a German guy, Ali Heidecker. He swings and misses a Nelly curveball in the dirt, and the ball is skipping away towards the first base dugout. Bedingfield dives for the ball, is parallel to the ground, and somehow fires a bullet to first base, beating Ollie by an eyelash. Game over. Best play you've ever seen a catcher make, ever. And then, let's see, there was one more thing. I'm told that your father, not only a musician, but an umpire, made Gary's first catcher's mask out of coat hangers. All of those things true?
I have to say yes to, I guess, all of those. Yeah, yeah. There's a great story with that coat hanger mask. And it was made of wire coat hangers with a little bit of kind of foam wrapped around it, and then just kind of like bicycle handlebar tape put around it. It had one bar across the front, so it would never have stopped anything. A baseball would have gone straight through and hit me in the top of the head, or would have hit me in the mouth. Maybe I wouldn't have got a broken nose. I mean, this was just our first season. But in 1981, that was the very first year I went to the US. So I was 18 years old. I went to Fenway Park, and we had contact through a newspaper guy who was in Manchester, New Hampshire, a guy named Bob Hilliard. And he arranged for me to meet George Brett because the Kansas City Royals were in town. And Bob had written an article about this face mask, this coat hanger face mask. He'd written about that in the newspaper. And I went and met George Brett, which was amazing because he was kind of my hero at that time. But as
mine too, by the way.
Yeah, just a wonderful guy as well as a wonderful player. And somebody was standing behind us, and I could sense there was somebody near us. And I looked around, and there was Hal McCray standing there with this huge grin on his face and his hands behind his back. And he said, "Hey, Gary, I've got some more coat hangers for you if you want to make yourself another mask." what a wonderful moment, really. Just that he obviously read that thing in the newspaper the morning before. And I don't know where that mask is these days, but that was my first catcher's mask. Yeah.
Baseball connections are incredible, aren't they? You played with Rob Nelson, who's a good friend of mine, and of course he's been on the podcast, and you met Hal McCray, and I came to know Hal's son Brian, who managed the Victoria Harbor Cats in the league I'm commissioner of right now. And it all if one of the great things about the game, as you know, is that once you get immersed, you just start meeting people, and it turns out everybody knows each other.
Yeah, it really is. It's a wonderful family. Baseball is a real family. It really is, and I've had the good fortune to meet so many sort of wonderful people along the way, and baseball is the game. That's my way of looking at it. Yeah.
Well, and you, the reason that I became aware of you, I think, even before I found out your connection with Nelly, is that you and I share these twin passions. I grew up in the 1970s just a kid. Like by the time I was 9 or 10 years old, the two things that I was obsessed with more than anything else were baseball and World War II history. And I certainly have gotten the impression that you share those passions. That's pretty obvious. And I mentioned in the intro the work that you've done. But I just, I love pure research. I feel like if someone else does the sort of research that you do, I can connect to him on a sort of visceral level, because I just love immersing myself in the archives and finding things, making lists and checking facts and seeing who's this in this photo? Oh, okay. You have done just this incredible amount of research on U.S. baseball players during the war, and other Japanese players too, by the way. But where did that I'm not surprised that you have a passion for World War II history, because my understanding is that's even more common in Great Britain than it is in the U.S. I've gotten that impression anyway. A lot of kids just grew up obsessing about war movies and the Desert Rats and Spitfires and all those things. But at what point did you put these two things together?
Like you said, Rob, my youth was the same as yours. It was baseball and it was World War II. I guess the World War II thing was first. Baseball came probably when I was about 12, 13. That was really when that started. But combining the two, I think, was probably a later part of my playing career, I guess, kind of mid-90s, I guess. I just felt there had to be a link. I love both things, and I think when you love two things, you think, how do these things cross over? And there wasn't really much to go on. There were a couple of books out there. Richard Goldstein had written a book called Spartan Seasons, and William B. Meade as well, with Even the Browns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So these were really the only two books at that time that had existed. And as much as they were great books, what they didn't really tell me was much about what was happening in the country I was living in, because we had millions of GIs come through the mm-hmm. UK, mm-hmm. As well as kind of the Army Air Force that was there throughout the war. And I guess what I was looking for was where's the link? What's the story here? Or is there a story? Maybe baseball was never played. And that's what I wanted to really find out, is kind of what was the military side of things. And I guess as I started to kind of dig through old newspaper archives, a story started to emerge. Stories started to emerge, loads of them, and things that I thought, this doesn't exist anywhere. Nobody's ever written about this stuff. Nobody's put this stuff together. A gap in the market, maybe you want to call it that. But I just felt that need to correct that and to start to put some of that information out there for other people to have a chance to see what happened. And that's, 20, 25 years ago.
And I'm curious about the genesis of the work. I mean, obviously, the you have the brand new book, and Baseball in Wartime, the newsletter, has been around for a while. And, of course, there's your other book, Baseball's Dead of World War II, which is essential research. I growing up and being interested in both subjects, at some point I realized that the war must have had an immense impact on professional baseball in the U.S. But there was not a resource for. We knew I learned fairly early on which players had been which major league players had been killed during World War II. I think at one point I actually scanned literally the entire baseball encyclopedia looking for making a list because I didn't have that source anywhere else. And of course we couldn't just Google things. And so I found that I think it's, is it four or five major league players who were killed in World War II? But I knew there must be many dozens more professional players. But I never had any way of finding it. But your book has all of them. And one of the things that I've never really understood is how you've been able to conduct this research, and especially before the, all the newspapers, or not all of them, a lot of newspapers and other resources came online. But you've not only done this amazing research, but you've done it thousands of miles from any U.S. microfilm. So how did you do it?
It started really with a newspaper called the Stars and Stripes. That was the mm-hmm. first newspaper, which was the U.S. military newspaper during World War II. And fortunately, we've got the complete archives for the European edition here in the U.K. And that was on... let me see. That I was going to say that was on microfilm, but it wasn't. That was actually the actual newspaper, so I could just kind of flick through all of those.
Wow.
So that gave me a lot of, I guess, a starting point, really. And once I started to get people's names, I would just... And quite often, these newspapers would mention somebody's name and then mention their hometown. So that was the key, really, for me to then write pen to paper and write... to the local library. In some cases, I'd write to the local mayor of that town and see what they could, see if they could track these people down for me. And I spent a good few years doing that until the internet came along, which kind of changed the whole approach to the way we do things. But a lot of it was done through the help of local libraries, local mayors, local historical societies, just by sending probably thousands of letters over years, trying to locate people to speak to them, to get their stories. A lot of telephone interviews, I guess, I did over a good few years. And it was a different type of, I guess, research back then from kind of what we do now. Now we just Google everything these days. But it was a much longer, slower process, but in some ways a much more rewarding process. You know, when mm-hmm. Receiving letters in the mail is something we don't really do anymore. We don't get that anymore. And the joy of getting a letter from somebody who may have been a minor league player and then served during World War II and wanted to share his story, because no one had asked him about his story for 50 years. And finally, somebody wanted to know, and they were just so forthcoming with so much information. It was incredible. I started this at a fortunate time when a lot of people were still with us. You know, we've lost the vast majority of them now, but at that time, there were a lot of people still alive who hadn't probably themselves even thought about what they did during the war. So it was kind of just a joy to communicate with so many of them for a long time.
One of the thoughts I had many years ago was that there was a story that hadn't been told. And I think you're basically the only one who's even come close to telling it. And that is the story that it's the essential truth that some significant number of future major league players and future major league star players must have been killed during the war, right? There's no way there's no way around the math for that. You know, most people, when they think about, who know about baseball players during the war, the general assumption, I think, is that the great players didn't actually, most of them weren't in much danger. Now there were exceptions. Buddy Lewis, flew missions over the hump mm-hmm. in Asia, which was a dangerous mission. Cecil Travis was in the Battle of the Bulge. He had been a star before the war. It was very strange how, and I'm sure you could speak to, I would love to hear your thoughts on, I've always wondered why this small number of star players were put in these incredibly dangerous situations, but it was only a very small number. Like, why Cecil Travis? Why did he wind up getting frozen feet in the Battle of the Bulge when most players were not assigned such duties? I don't think there's any real reason for it. It's just randomness. And, you know, as you well know, the military is not famed for its efficiency in any war, but I think you would agree that not a generation, but some significant percentage of a generation of great players was lost during the war, whether because they were killed, because they were injured, or simply because they were sidetracked from their professional career, right?
Yeah. One of the things that did bother me when I first started looking at kind of wartime baseball was there was a list that used to kind of knock around on various forums and you could find in different books of players that were killed in World War II. And there were about 15 names on that list.
And this is professional players.
Yeah, this is professional players. And I thought,
right,
there's something wrong with that number.
Right.
That's not enough. Yeah. It doesn't make sense. Right. There's got to be more. And when I started to kind of dig a little deeper, I could add to that list. And then it just kept growing. And the book that you mentioned, Baseball's Dead of World War II, that has 127 names in that book. So, you know, that list has grown from 15 that was around for so many years to 127. There's actually around 160 that I've now got on the website.
Wow.
So that's just since I wrote that book. We've added, you know, another 30 or more to that list. And there will continue to be more. And some of them were outstanding players. They absolutely were. And I think some of them would have had major league careers. And, you know, for so many of them, they're the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
I think that's the story, really, with people like Cecil Travis. Just happened to be where he was at that time, and the unit that he happened to be attached to just happened to get shipped to Europe, and that's just the way things fell. And other guys were fortunate enough to be with units that didn't get shipped out of the U.S. and were able to play baseball throughout the war, or got shipped to Hawaii maybe and played there.
And there are other players. Maybe people don't. Maybe everyone listening doesn't know that. Players who were in combat situations weren't killed, later became superstars. Warren Spahn, for example,
as I
recall, he was working on the bridge at the famous Remagen Bridge, and wasn't there for the initial capture, but was there when it was being bombed and saw comrades being injured and killed. Hoyt Wilhelm, I believe, wound up with a Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you
fought
did.
In Western Europe. And there were others. You know, there are also, even in addition to the players who were killed, and you keep track of those, must have been professional players who were injured and never quite recovered. There must have been talented 17 and 18-year-olds in 1941, 42 who literally never got a chance to play pro ball.
Yeah.
Because they were in the service before they had a chance to sign professionally and just never. So there must be literally hundreds of young men whose baseball careers were profoundly impacted by the war, and many of them we'll just never know about.
Yeah.
But I think it's an important story that needs to be told and that you have told.
That was one of the reasons that I kind of expanded the website to include high school players, sandlot players, college players. And they're all under the kind of separate categories. I just thought, you know, if baseball was a big part of somebody's life, and then that opportunity to take that further was taken away, then they just kind of need to be remembered somewhere. I mean, I'll never have all the high school players who lost their lives. I'll never have all the college players who lost their lives. But you know, as many as I can find, I'll put on there just to remember them, because you know, baseball was a big part of their life, and unfortunately, we've lost them.
And it's funny. I don't know if you've ever. I'm sure you've run across this in your research, but it seems that the military was quite a bit more cavalier about the football players. I believe a significant number of well-known college and even pro football players saw combat and were killed.
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't looked a great deal into football. I'm very much a one sport guy. Mm-hmm. It's baseball is. I don't follow any other sport at all. You know, coming from the UK, I should, I guess, be a big soccer fan, but I'm not. So I've really just kind of stuck with the one sport. But yeah, I've definitely seen records that show that a lot of football players. I guess, you know, baseball at the time was the national pastime, and there is no doubt that some players, I guess, were protected to some extent and right. You know, maybe kept safe to some extent because they were such big, high-profile people, but maybe football players didn't have that privilege, I guess.
Register now for the Summer of Sabre Golden Celebration Series as we commemorate 50 years of Sabre. With 9 incredible virtual sessions over the summer, including the full Jerry Molloy Negro League Conference, there's something for every baseball fan. Visit sabre.org/summer.
This is a great way to segue into talking about your new book, which is fantastic. So many military units had baseball teams that it was in kind of probably an easy call for a lot of commanding officers to say, I think I'd like this guy to play for my baseball team rather than get shipped off to combat. Right. And the new book, The Research in Baseball in Hawaii During World War II, is just incredible. Now, you mentioned Stars and Stripes and the UK edition, but how on earth did you find all the information about players in Hawaii?
Well, you know, the last 25 years that I've been doing this, lots of stuff has come my way. Yeah, lots of kind of indirect. I've looked a lot at Europe and what happened there, but I've also kind of looked at the kind of Pacific theater in that area and looking at what happened there. So I've gathered a lot of stuff over the years. So really just kind of going through old archives that I've got, but also kind of looking at online newspapers. Again, we're coming back to this online resource being such a great tool that we have now. Looking at Honolulu newspapers, there were two main newspapers in Honolulu, and there were papers for the other islands. A lot of those you can access online. And really just kind of going through that, and going through, I guess, on a day-to-day basis to really see what was happening pretty much with every day from 1941 until kind of early days of 1946, really. So a lot of time, I guess, looking at newspapers, gathering all of that, looking at previous archives, calling on people that I know have done research on this before. Harrington Crissy Jr., who's a wonderful guy, has done so much research on Navy baseball during World War II. And you know, calling upon him, I've known him for so many years now, and you know, he's got a great archive of information. So just really just bringing everything together, I guess. It was a new venture for me. You know, I knew a lot of baseball had happened in Hawaii, but nothing had ever been really written about kind of it's from its start to its finish, from 41 to 45. There was stuff about the 44 Service World Series, and there was stuff about the 45 Navy All-Star Game. I'd read stuff about that, but what happened in between? That was what intrigued me, and I thought, well, I need to find out. So, that was the start of my most recent adventure.
And, you know, it's fascinating to see that there are all these different, not just teams, which I knew there were any number of teams. I didn't realize that there were all these different leagues. I'm just flipping through. There's the Hawaii League and the Honolulu League and the CPA League, the 14th Naval District League, including the Catlin Marines Raiders and the Pearl Harbor Submarine Base B. I mean, the lists go on and on. And these were all covered in the newspapers.
To a pretty fair extent, yeah, they really were. There are a few military publications that you can get hold of. It's hard to get hold of all of them, and it's hard to get hold of a good run of them. But you know, odd copies seem to exist here and there, so I managed to find a few things. The Hall of Fame has got some archives as well. Obviously, they've got archives, but they've got some great kind of military wartime archives, and they're always very, very helpful with anything that I'm looking for. They really do kind of dig deep and see what they can find. So it's really just kind of putting all these pieces together. You know, the information is out there, but somebody just needs, I guess, to join all those dots.
Which you've done. Now, would it be an exaggeration to suggest that in, say, 1944 or 45, a serviceman in Hawaii could see a game or games that featured more talent than you would see in a major league stadium in the States?
I guess that's probably my belief that the baseball being played in Hawaii in 1944, 1945 was better than what was happening back home. There were 13, 14 Hall of Famers, future Hall of Famers, all playing at the same time in Hawaii. And that's a crazy number of future Hall of Fame players. Bill Dickey, Joe DiMaggio, Joe Gordon, Pee Wee Reese, Red Ruffing, Ted Williams, Bob Lemon, Ted Lyons, Johnny Mize, Stan Musial, Phil Rizzuto, Enos Slaughter, Billy Herman. All these guys are Hall of Famers that were all playing in leagues at exactly the same time. So, and a question kind of comes up, were they playing for real or were they just kind of going through the motions? And from what I have heard, that the majority of the time they were playing for real. So I think that servicemen would have seen some exceptional baseball in Hawaii during those years. And it was all about entertainment for the troops. That's what it was all about. But, you know, I think the troops can tell the difference between a game that's being played properly and a game that's just going through the motions.
Right, absolutely. And I know that during the war, and I don't know if you've studied this much, but during the war there was an immense amount of speculation about these players and how being away from Major League Baseball would affect them when they came back. There were I don't know how many times I've seen stories suggesting that these guys wouldn't be able to play at all, basically. Either the war would last so long, and there were people who thought the war was going to last for the entire decade, that they just wouldn't, they'd be too old to come back, or that when they did come back after 3, 4, 5 years, whatever it was, Hank Greenberg's an example, that they would simply be too rusty to play. There's a quote in your book, Hank Greenberg suggesting when he goes back into the service in, I believe, 1942, that his career's over, right? Because by the time the war's over, and he's going to stay in for the duration, he'd be too old to play. Now, of course, as we know, a huge number of players came back and were roughly as good as you would expect them to be. Based on just their career path prior to the war. Ted Williams may be one of the great examples, but there are any number of others, Bob Feller, et cetera, et cetera. There were a few players who didn't come back quite as good as strong as they'd been, but of course you would expect some percentage of players to decline regardless. And I've always wondered if maybe whether so many players came back strong just because that's the nature of athleticism, or because in certainly not in all cases, but in many cases, they'd gotten to play top level competition during the war.
I think so. I think it kept a lot of players in shape. Definitely, being able to play in highly competitive leagues. Yeah, I've looked kind of at the stats for some of those leagues, and the hitters weren't coming up with crazy numbers. If you look at the 1945. 14th Naval District League. I think it was Billy Herman that led that league with a 408 average. Sam Musial hit 380 that year. But, you know, there weren't guys hitting with big numbers. There was nobody hitting over 500 or anything ridiculous like that. The stats were, in a way, fairly sort of comparable, really, to maybe what was happening. So that just tells you that the pitching must have been pretty good. As far as I can tell, that these leagues were competitive and that kept people in shape for a number of years. You know, some of them were there for a good few years. There's a player who didn't play after the war, but Sid Gautreau, who played for the Dodgers in the, I think, 1936, 37, was a catcher with the Dodgers. He was there from end of 42 until the end of 1945. So he was in Hawaii for a long time. He's not one of the players that came back and played after the war, but certainly plenty of them did. And I think just that time, that opportunity to play, kept them in shape. I think there are a few that actually suffered injuries that while they were playing in the military that ended their career. Bob Lemon is an interesting one because Bob Lemon went into service as a third baseman and came out as a pitcher and ended up as a Hall of Fame pitcher. So it kind of worked for Bob, yeah.
And then there were a few players. You probably would remember the name. I believe there was a Cardinals pitcher. Was it maybe Al Brazel? That's probably not right. But pitched in Hawaii and actually hurt his arm. And when he came back, he wasn't the same because he'd gotten hurt in Hawaii. Does that sound familiar? Some Cardinals pitcher, I think.
Yeah, I think there was. Did that happen to Johnny Beasley?
That's it. Yeah, Johnny Beasley. Yeah. Yes, not Brazel Beasley. I've got my B's and my Z's mixed up.
Yeah, I think it definitely happened with a few of them. Where I think there was something about the weather in Hawaii. Was I think what I heard that there's a steady breeze that means you never really get warmed up. I seem to remember reading that somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely happened to some that they just kind of threw their arms out. But again, that's going to happen no matter where you play.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I've always, and I'm sure that you've written about some of the. Is there one particular game or maybe series in Hawaii where the most talent came? Because I believe there's a famous set of games played in Europe in 1945. Was there anything similar in Hawaii?
Yeah, I think there were two. The 1944 Service World Series, I think, is probably the big one with all the real kind of big names in there. That should have included,
this is Army versus Navy.
This is Army versus Navy. Yeah, so you can imagine the rivalry that is there right from the start. You know, just with the two branches of the service playing against each other. That was a big one. The Navy had Phil Rizzuto, Joe Grace, Barney McCoskey, Johnny Myers.
Virgil Trucks?
Yeah, Virgil Trucks, Dom DiMaggio, Pee Wee Reese. You know, this team is a crazy team.
And they played a ton of games, right? 11 games?
They played 11 games, yeah. It went to 7 games with regards to the actual series itself, but they then played another 4 games on other islands just for entertainment of troops that were on other Hawaiian islands.
Yeah, let me run through the Navy All-Stars, or most of the names, just in case you might have missed a couple that people know. Yeah. Rizzuto, McCoskey, who was a star. Schoolboy Rowe, Johnny Mize, Dom DiMaggio, I would assume, yeah, Pee Wee Reese, Dickey, Trucks, Vandermeer, Hugh Casey, Tom Farrick, Bat Masterson. It's a Major League All-Star team, basically.
It really is, yeah. And the Army may not have had quite as much to offer, but they still had a pretty decent team. I mean, they certainly had Joe Gordon on the team.
It looks to me like the Army's problem was their best pitcher was Johnny Beasley, and otherwise they didn't have any stars at all. But no, they had some stars in the lineup for sure.
Yeah. I think they were just a little short on pitching. Yeah, I think that was their problem. The Navy pulled out all the stops to make sure they had the best. I mean, they shipped in two players from Australia, Phil Rizzuto and I think it was Pee Wee Reese. Both came in from Australia for the series and then flew back.
Now, was there any? Do you know if there was any backlash in the States during the war regarding the high profile players playing so much baseball?
You know, I'm not aware of any, really. I haven't really seen much at all of anything along those sort of lines. And that's sort of a question. How did the big league teams feel about their players playing overseas?
Right.
When he's not making any money for us while he's over there doing what he's doing. I don't know. You know, I think it was a different time. Yeah, that's a big part of it. I think it was a very different time. I think we had different attitudes then from maybe what we've got now. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, I was just thinking the other day that Ralph Kiner, who was in Hawaii during the war, didn't get to play any baseball because he was busy flying a PBM Mariner flying boat. Now, here's a future Hall of Famer who is flying patrols off the coast of Hawaii.
Well, I mean, as you're well aware, nobody was really considered, you know, as a class of Americans. Nobody was considered exempt, and the same was true in really every country that was in the war. I mean, Japanese players obviously were pressed into service. Any number of, I only know this because I'm do a lot of research about war movies, and you find that any number of great British actors in war movies actually were in the war.
Yeah, you're right.
Right? I mean, these guys, talk about experience. And Jimmy Stewart famously flew dozens and dozens of missions in B-24 bombers. Douglas Fairbanks Jr., who was a movie star, saw combat in Europe. So people weren't exempt. It didn't matter how famous you were. Yeah, you could, you know, if you're Joe DiMaggio, the government probably doesn't want you manning a trench on Guadalcanal for some obvious reasons.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at Joe DiMaggio in that sense, but then if you look at Ted Williams, Ted Williams was a fighter pilot who trained to be a fighter pilot, was shipped out to Hawaii ready to go to combat, and the war ended. So you've got, you know, DiMaggio who didn't go anywhere near the war, and yet Ted Williams, who was pretty close to getting there, and of course did later on in the Korean War.
Right. No, they different times.
Yeah. It is different times. Yeah.
That just wouldn't happen. I don't know if it's because we don't consider wars existential at this point in history, but it just doesn't happen anymore. So tell me a little bit about the newsletter, when you started doing it, what you see for its future.
Okay. Newsletter started 2007. That was the year that I was invited to speak at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. There was a World War II baseball convention happening there, and that just kind of sparked a lot of news stories and things that were happening. And I had the website running for a few years, but I launched that first newsletter in 2007, and it kind of comes and goes, I think, is the thing with the newsletter. It's come and gone 50 times so far, so there are 50, maybe 51 issues out there, so there's quite a lot of them. But it's, as far as its future is concerned, I don't know. As soon as I get an urge to put something else out there, I will. I've got no real agenda for it. It's just the whole Hawaii book kind of started as a number of newsletters. The last three or four newsletters are about Hawaii, and I realized I can't get all this into a newsletter. And there's so much more that I want to say, which is really what, you know, how the kind of the book happened off the back of those newsletters. I still get a lot of interest with regards to the newsletter, and it'll keep happening. I'll keep coming up with new issues here and there. Yeah. So, but
and for people who want to dive right in, the website is just a fantastic resource, and including, you've got, I don't know how many player biographies, but it certainly is reminiscent of the Saber Bio Project. And if someone can't find someone they wanted at the Bio Project, and they served during the war, you've probably got them, right?
Yeah, I think what I've also got on there is the Saber Bio Project. There's lots of great biographies on there. But if you're looking to fill the gap about what they did during World War II, which is not always on there, then I've got that little extra bit there as well to go with that. Yeah.
Right. You know, it's funny. I think I might have first run across your work when I was researching the book that I never wound up writing about Billy Southworth Jr., which I'm sure you and I have corresponded about long ago. But it's just, it's just such essential work, I think, what you're doing. And it's kind of amazing to me that a Brit is the one who wound up doing it.
Yeah, it is. It is weird. that's all I can say. It is. It's a little strange, but I said before, you know, I think when baseball gets a hold of you, that's it. You're stuck. You've got no choice, and it just grabs you. And you're like yourself with that World War II interest as well. I do kind of like to narrow things down to something, and I think that, you know, that being able to narrow my baseball interest down to that period is, and to realize that there's still so much more to do, that'll keep me going for the rest of my days.
So I just finished a book, and people are already asking me what's next. And my answer is, I don't know yet. But I'm going to ask you anyway. Is there anything that's really piqued your interest? I mean, the new book is fantastic. I hope everybody listening goes out and especially if you're interested in World War II, goes out and finds it. But I don't want to ask you what your next book is, but what's really sparking you right now in terms of research?
You know, I'm still looking at Hawaii. I must admit, I'm still, it's, I mean, there is a lot in the book. There is a 350, 360 pages, I think.
Yes.
There's about 160 biographies in there, just many biographies of the players, all your league standings and things, but I still feel there's more. So I'm still looking, and maybe there'll be an expanded version of that in a couple of years. I'd like to do the same thing for Europe. I think that that's something that I'm playing around with. I think I've kind of rewarded myself with a brief holiday. I think I'm just gonna back off for a little while, and then I'll probably get stuck back into things. And I think that Europe, in that sort of depth, I think is something that needs to be done. So I'd like to do that, and that will probably incorporate North Africa as well, because there's a lot of baseball happening in North Africa and kind of that Mediterranean area as well. So I think that could be where I'll go next. And again, it's really just a case of just pulling together all the stuff that I've got. The archives over 25 years are pretty massive.
You must have images of baseball games in North Africa, right? I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, I do. I do have some of those. Yeah,
so that sounds incredible.
Yeah. There was a lot happening in North Africa. It was a lot of troops were there. Operation Torch.
Yep.
Yeah,
the Torch landings. Yeah. Yep. 1942.
So, so we had a lot of troops out there. So there's lots to write about, and I think that's probably going to be that next step. That Europe incorporating that kind of North Africa area as well.
Gary, this has been so much fun. It's been great to finally get a chance to speak to you after all these years. And I am just grateful for all that you've done, and just a real admirer of your work.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. It really has. Thank you.
You bet. Take care.
Regístrate hoy para el Summer of Sabre Golden Celebration Series, en donde celebraremos el 50 aniversario de Sabre. Este tendrá 9 conferencias virtuales durante todo el verano, incluyendo el Jerry Malloy Negro League Conference. Para más detalles, visita sabre.org/summer.
Now I'm thrilled to welcome, as usual, Sabre CEO Scott Bush. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
I am well. Enjoying the rainy Portland weather, probably our last good drenching until September or October, and I'm trying to enjoy every moment of it.
Very good. I'm not super familiar with the weather
drenching
patterns up there. nor am I acclimated to any forms of precipitation any longer. So
no, I would think not.
Did you get the chance to go to any games this weekend? Did you do anything? Were you stuck in the house because of rain?
I went out for a couple of short conditioning hikes between the heavy downpours, but no, we actually was supposed to see a Portland Rosebuds game Sunday night. The Rosebuds, as you might know, were a very short-lived Negro Leagues team in 1946, owned by Jesse Owens, and one of our local outfits here, the Portland Pickles, who I've talked about on this show probably, in the West Coast League. Well, they created last summer a sort of a farm league and played. And I went to some, got to go to some, my baseball experiences last summer were Wild Wild West League games. And the league is still here, is still around this year. And they added this team, the Portland Rosebuds, to honor those 1946 Rosebuds. And Sunday night was supposed to be their first game, and it got rained out. So I'm hoping to go Thursday and see them play their first game. And it's kind of neat to see there. We don't really know anything about the Rosebuds uniforms at all. So they had to come up with a whole new sort of retro design, which I really like, but it's going to be fun to finally see them on the field.
Awesome. Excellent. Excellent. Well, we always convene to talk about who won the weekend. Do you have a winner this weekend?
Sure. I'll go with the Toronto Blue Jays power hitters, who became Sunday the very first team, the Blue Jays, in history to hit 8 home runs against the Red Sox in a single game.
Yes. It was a display, that's for sure.
It was a display. And I thought, oh, I wonder if they pulled ahead of the Red Sox. No, they didn't pull ahead of the Red Sox in the standings. They're still well behind the Red Sox, but they do have a better run differential after beating them 18-4 on Sunday. So there is that. And the Blue Jays are a more impressive team than I'd given them credit for. And this is not big news, but I would assume that their troika of Biggio, and Bichette, and of course Guerrero is something that we've literally never seen in the history of Major League Baseball, and it's even more fun to watch them when they're all playing well.
Yeah, what are the chances that there are 340 home run hitters in that group? It's possible. Maybe not this season, but it's possible.
Right. It is possible. Yep. I mean, we're going to have...
And they've been doing all of this without George Springer.
Right.
Scoring a lot of runs. Prolific offense and no George Springer as yet this year. So...
That's right. No, when he comes back, I mean, obviously... Probably one of these guys is going to fall off, but I mean, this is an impressive, impressive group of hitters. And the pitching is better than I thought it was. They just haven't been super lucky on the run differential thing and all that. But you look at their starting pitchers and do they have some holes? Sure. But they also have some real talent in that rotation. So they are contenders. No question.
Yep. No doubt. No doubt.
How about you?
Well, I took the White Sox, swept the Tigers over the weekend, won 5 of 6. Wake up this morning with the largest division lead in baseball at 5.5 games. And very, very excited to watch the series that starts tomorrow. They're hosting the Rays, which could also be, you know, so the two best records in baseball. Also, a bit of a... irresistible force and immovable object situation. The White Sox home record 25-11, the Rays away record 23-10. So very excited to see those two teams match up starting tomorrow night.
I was thinking about the White Sox last night, and I know we're only 40-some% of the way into the season, and a lot could change and will change in some cases, but we both probably have vivid memories of people saying, I don't think we were quite among them, but people saying that Tony La Russa was not the right man for this team. Do you remember those stories?
Yeah, and it's possible they could win a lot of games and maybe he's still not, but I do
absolutely
hear what you're saying.
Yeah. We as humans and certainly as baseball fans and analysts have a tendency to jump to easy conclusions. And that was an easy one. It was a really easy one. And it might still turn out to be true, but so far, if we judge La Russa as we normally judge managers,
yes,
he's done a fine job.
Yes. I can think of a team that I root for that, struggling a lot more. So
yes, I can think of between the Yankees and the Twins,
not a Twins fan, Rob.
Not great. I know you're not,
even
but
though
you
would
but
like
you
me
were.
To be.
You have been a Twins fan in the past.
That's
I'm
true.
Just saying there's a somewhere in the deep down in the recesses of your twisted mind that somehow turned to the dark side. You're like Darth Vader. Deep
I'm nothing like Darth
Luke,
Vader.
Luke could reach through and find that Twinkies fan.
Although I did watch the Twins AAA affiliate last week. In
person. Oh, nice.
Yes. I was in St. Paul. Fun little anecdote. Byron Buxton was on rehab assignment. He hit a triple earlier in the game. In the eighth inning, he singled. Batter behind him singled. So first and second, and they were only up a run. At which point, I can only assume because they didn't want to tempt the third base coach, Byron Buxton was lifted for a pinch runner, which quite possibly the first time that's ever happened in his life. And I was there. So that was fun.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. It was good.
Scott, I wanted to start a new tradition this week. We've had so many fantastic guests, and they always have things happening, new things and updates. And projects, and I wanted to mention a couple of those this week. And we're never going to be able to keep up because we've had so many guests and they do so many things. But just this weekend, I happened to run across a couple of things. First, Howard Bryant, who's been working on this book about his new book about Ricky Henderson, presented the new cover, and you can pre-order from the publisher, and that looks like a fantastic book, and I can't wait to read it.
Titled Ricky, by the way, right?
Yes, Ricky, with a subtitle, The Life and Legend of an American Original. Great-looking cover image. And the other one was Daniel Horine, and it might be Horine because I've forgotten how he told me how he pronounces his name. Apologies to Daniel. He started season 3 this week of his Pop Fly Prince. And the first is Big Unit, featuring Randy Johnson. And Randy Johnson's working with him, working with Daniel. Well, there will be signed editions. And he showed that this weekend, what that's going to look like. And it's really, really nice. So a couple of really cool things coming out soon from our friends of the podcast, as I like to call them. Now, I know you have some news. The Summer of Saber is coming up very soon.
Yeah, Summer of Saber starting on the 25th of June. And for those not familiar, somehow, this August will be Saber's official 50th anniversary. And we are celebrating with little sessions, I'll call them, one weekend a month, June, July, August. The first of which is June 25 through 27. And if you join us for that, we've got panels on the future of women in baseball, the next 50 years of baseball, a panel on baseball rules changes. That's just all on Friday, June 25th. And on Saturday, June 26th, we've got a panel with Sean Foreman of Baseball Reference, Gary Ashwell of Seamheads, and Larry Lester of Sabres Negro Leagues Committee. That's going to be focused on the Negro Leagues as major leagues, and specifically what that change in recognition means for statistics, data, things like that. Also that day, we've got our annual business meeting. So if Sabre governance is your thing, that's the date for you. And then on Sunday, June 27th, we're working a lot with international baseball, specifically national baseball teams and professional leagues in the Caribbean and Latin America. So focusing in on that. And you can attend any of these sessions for a single registration fee of $35, which gets you into everything. Later on this year, the July sessions will be entirely Sabres Jerry Molloy Negro League Conference. In August, we've also got some amazing programming on tap, including a one-on-one with none other than Howard Bryant. So excited about all of it. But June is first, and I hope you guys will check it out. You can find more information at sabre.org/summer.
What a summer. I am looking forward to all of the above. So thanks to everybody for putting everything together. It's tough not having the convention, being able to see everybody, but there is a lot of fantastic things happening instead.
Yeah, and you know, we tried to scale back, honestly, from last summer. This is modestly less, but it's also spread out a lot more than we did last summer. You know, I mentioned I went to a ball game the other day. You've been able to get out and see some, and I've talked to a lot of people that have been out and about and doing things like that. And I think people are ready to do things in person, and I don't fault them for wanting to do that when the weather's nice in the summer and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're trying our best to sort of find the balance there and provide great ways for Sabre members to gather and enjoy. And honestly, you don't have to be a member to attend these sessions. So if you listen to this show regularly and somehow you're not, feel free to join us anyway. And Rob, have you had the chance to read anything in the last week?
Well, you might recall a week or two ago, I mentioned that I was reading the new book about Dave Parker, Cobra, or by Dave Parker, I should say, and finished that and enjoyed it a great deal. Dave Parker mentioned in his book, Willie Stargell's autobiography, which was released in 1983, I believe. And I thought, you know what? That sounds like an interesting book. I wonder if I have that. And I do have it. And I spent the last week reading it. And it was quite interesting. I feel like I probably don't need to read any more about the 1970s Pirates ever again. But both of these books were really informative. And it was such an interesting team. All I really remembered about the Pirates was 1979 and the famous We Are Family team. But it turns out that that whole We Are Family theme pretty much was the environment for that entire decade, where you would, if you were a bucko, you were part of that family. It wasn't just 79. It went on for years and years, and it was largely because of Stargell. So it's a lot of fun to read his book, and I can't believe that I never had read it before, because I've had it for a long, long time. So that was great.
As an aside,
yes,
it is amazing to me that so much of organizational culture, and specifically team organizational culture, is never presented from the perspective of players.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think is unique about hearing stories about those Pirates teams, because it was driven by Stargell. But when you hear other quotes, anecdotes, stories, things like that about playing insert team name here baseball, it's seldom from the perspective of a player.
Right.
It's almost always a manager or management talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that's almost... there's almost a gap in how that's covered, reported, or simply how that information is shared. And it is because we don't ask the players.
Well, I think that, yes, I think that is true. But I also think it's true that the players don't, in many cases, they don't want to talk about those things. Because if you talk about it, then it's not yours anymore. If that makes sense. I mean, all the players on those Pirates teams, all the ones we remember anyway, had nicknames, team nicknames. And maybe half of those don't show up on their baseball reference pages because they weren't talked about publicly. Ed Ott, for example, their catcher, was the Troll. That doesn't show up anywhere. And there are a bunch of those. Bill James mentioned this a long time ago in one of his books, that the real nicknames, that ones they use for each other, we don't hear about because they're for them, not for us. And I think that the chemistry stuff or the team culture stuff, yeah, I mean, they talk about it, but I think to some degree they don't want that out in the world. It's a private thing that they don't want to share with the writers. And yeah, some writers will do some digging and really get into it, but I think that's not sort of the general, it's not a generally done, because the players don't really want to talk about it a whole lot.
Interesting. Interesting. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, you didn't. I don't think so. I think I was just going to mention that I was reading a good baseball prospectus article about another one about strikeouts. This one by Rob Maines. Basically the question Rob was asking was, is the problem the player's approach? And he looked at not only young hitters, but also veteran hitters to see if the veteran hitters, the ones who theoretically wouldn't be as likely to change their approach, have seen the same strikeout effect as younger hitters. And the answer is yes, they have. Strikeouts are up, Scott, 42% between 2005 and 2020. Which was even more than I would have guessed. And it's hard to keep track, obviously, but there are a lot of different ways to slice the strikeout pie. But 42% in 16 seasons is obviously significant.
Yes, yes, it is.
To say the least. And I want to mention, I'll post a link to that article on the show page. And of course, we always encourage people to visit the show page. And this week, I hope people visit and check out Gary Bedingfield's work, because it's fascinating stuff, and it was so much fun to speak to him. I think he's the first guest we've had from overseas, so that was a lot of fun.
Very cool. Thanks so much, Rob.
My pleasure. Take care, Scott.
This has been SaberCast with Rob Nyer, a production of the Society for American Baseball Research. You can find Saber on Twitter and Facebook, and find even more baseball research, previous episodes of SaberCast, bonus content from this episode, and a list of what Rob's reading at saber.org. Music for SaberCast is provided by The Baseball Project.